I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. Okay, let me just insert this and rewind a bit. Okay, here we go.
Can you hear me? It's hard to hear my voice with these headphones on.
Okay, that's better. This week on The Butterfly Effect, we're going back to 1979. That was a big year, mostly not for good reasons. American embassy staff were taken hostage by Iranian revolutionaries. The USSR invaded Afghanistan. Skylab crashed to Earth. The Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown happened in Pennsylvania. But amongst all the dark news, there were a few bright lights. The board game Trivial Pursuit came out, Pink Floyd released The Wall, and Japanese audio company Sony began selling a portable cassette player it called the Walkman. And that's what we're here to talk about today. From the vantage point of 2022, the Sony Walkman looks like an absurdly large, cumbersome beast of a device that either clipped on your belt or required a shoulder strap and played lo-fi cassette tapes. But the thing is, it was also revolutionary. It meant you could take your music with you while you rode the bus, did the 20-minute workout, or read a book in a library. And nobody had been able to do that before. Sure, it wasn't 1,000 songs in your pocket, it was more like 10, and it didn't really fit in a pocket, but it paved the way for the iPod, streaming, and the personal entertainment on-demand world we live in today. So this week on The Butterfly Effect, it's the long tail of the mixtape.
Well, the story went was that Morita, the Sony chairman, was annoyed at his children playing loud music in their house. And so he thought, if only they could have headphones on and he didn't have to hear it. And so this was the founding myth. I'm Michael Bull. And I'm a professor of sound studies at the University of Sussex in the UK. 15 years ago, on the web, I was known as Professor iPod. It was a joke, and then it became institutionalized.
So a big and obvious question to begin. Can you give me a primer on the creation and the marketing of the Sony Walkman?
It wasn't really an invention at all. It was putting a cassette deck and a pair of headphones plugged in. That's all it is. which Sony discovered when they went to court on the basis that it was an invention. And the court said, no, it's not an invention. It's a juxtaposition of existing technologies. But that was the beginning, supposedly, of the Sony Walkman in 1979.
You know, I have this very clear memory of my Uncle Dean showing us his Walkman. He was a jogger and he was the first person I knew who had one. Can you talk a little bit about the reception and kind of the cultural impact and the cultural cachet of the Walkman?
Yeah, the Walkman was a kind of instant success. It needed very little advertising, just a little bit, and it was marketed for young people, essentially, yeah? And unbeknown to Sony, it tapped into a kind of individualized market. You know, we all got brought up, not you, but me, I got brought up in a, you know, where everybody wanted to be like their next door neighbor. Yeah, yeah. So it's like, you know, it goes back to the old Henry Ford thing where you can have any color you want for your Model T Ford as long as it's black. So it's the idea is that I want to be like you, et cetera, et cetera. And to some extent, in the 50s, things like television, et cetera, was that mass market thing, yeah? If you wanted to listen to music, you kind of had to listen to it on the radio. But of course, as soon as you bought a record player or you started listening at home, that's much more personalized and individualized. And so essentially what the Walkman did was allow normally young people, not just young people, to take their music with them. Yeah. And so essentially it was this individual experience of whatever it was you were doing. And that was an important cultural moment not recognized by Sony.
Yeah.
So it was an accident, really.
Yeah.
You know, when you interviewed people using the Walkman, obviously it was quite complicated in some ways, but it was this idea that you could take portability, you could take your music for the first time ever, the ones that you had chosen yourself. So you could actually, you could buy a cassette deck, but most people actually recorded their own cassettes from their record players.
Yes.
Or tape recorders. And so they would have their playlists, etc., etc. And that was revolutionary. You couldn't, you know, you couldn't do that listening to the radio. You couldn't even do it in a record shop, you know. But you could actually produce a kind of narrative that fitted in with either what you wanted or you could give it to a friend.
Yes.
I mean, what more romantic thing could you do than think about the other person, think of the playlist you want,
yes,
and then give it to them.
Yes.
And then imagine them walking around. I mean, that's fantastic. That was totally new.
So I know that you're saying it was a juxtaposition rather than an invention, but did it involve any kind of novel technology, like even just the miniaturization of the idea of the tape deck?
Not much. I mean, you could buy quite a small cassette player anyway. It did become more miniaturized. You're right up to a point that it's the beginning of a process of miniaturization. And we associate that with portability.
Yeah.
And so what we see is it's the beginning of technologies becoming smaller and smaller so you can carry them. I mean, paradoxically, now they're getting bigger and bigger again,
mm-hmm.
as you know, with your phone.
Yes.
And that notion of portability and miniaturization becomes increasingly important. But also, when you're looking at the Walkman itself, actually, it's a precursor to the mobile phone.
Mm.
So the idea that you are taking something with you. Now, obviously the Walkman is something more internal, but it's this notion of taking your private life out into the public.
Right.
Which then becomes universalized with mobile phones many years later. But it sets the ground for that in terms of its acceptability. Because the critique of the Walkman when it first came out was the older generation normally saying it's antisocial.
Yes.
You're putting your headphones on. You can't hear what other people are saying, as if we ever listen to other people when we're walking around the street.
Indeed, it might be a bit rude to do that. But
but there was a sort of like a stigma attached.
Mm.
And I remember one person who was using it, a woman on the underground tube in London, and she said wearing the Walkman was a bit like a guilty pleasure But it was a little bit like opening your handbag out and showing people the contents in public. So that kind of, so it had a negative connotation. And so you were kind of rebelling against that negative connotation by using it.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit more about the playlist or the mixtape that people would make? Because I have very clear memories of, first of all, putting an extraordinary amount of effort into them. But also, you know, you would decorate the cassette box itself. It was a very sort of artistic kind of, or creative at least, type of process.
Yeah, I think it's the most original thing. Because all these things are not just listening, they're touch as well, and what they look like, et cetera, et cetera. And people would often, you know, kind of stroke their albums and stuff like that. And of course, it represented, I think, an expansion of musical taste from that period of time as well. So people were hopping from one genre to the next. And again, it goes back to, you know, the early 60s, late 50s, where there wasn't much breadth in what you could listen to. So by the time you got to the 70s, for example, you did have lots of different radio shows. You know, you could go to massive record stores and look at almost everything that was there, essentially. And so this enabled you to collate quite a broad variety of music that wasn't necessarily within the genre. And so if you were thinking of your boyfriend, girlfriend, or whatever, or even thinking about yourself in terms of tapes for different moods or occasions. So it's not just externalized, it's also internalized. So somebody might have a tape for being happy tape.
Yes.
Being miserable tape. I'm surprised how many people had miserable tapes, because it was this idea of being totally consumed in your mood. You know, so if you can imagine, I mean, you're a bit Canadian, you know, a tape full of Leonard Cohen songs.
Right. Right. I may have had one of those.
I think I might have done as well. So the idea of a kind of continuity to keep you in the mood that you were in. And music essentially is an incredibly powerful sonic aphrodisiac. Yeah. It's the most successful thing to keep you, or either keep you in your mood or change your mood.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cognitive, the way you think or the way you feel, suddenly became controllable wherever you went.
Mm-hmm. Were there ways that the music industry responded specifically to the Walkman?
Nothing like as much as with the arrival of the iPod.
Yeah.
The idea of taping music you'd already bought didn't have the same cultural significance as people using music for free with the iPod. So it didn't have that same connotation.
This is Spark from CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, and today on a special Butterfly Effect edition of Spark, we've been talking about the impact and legacy of the Sony Walkman and portable cassette players more generally. I've been speaking to Michael Bull, Professor of Sound Studies at the University of Sussex in England.
You recorded stuff off the radio, as I did way back as well. Just having something with you as your own traveling device, it was kind of eye-opening at the time. And I was thinking of my own progression, you know, from the Walkman to a Discman to MP3 players and so on. And now it's, I don't think too many people are buying one off of any of those, really, other than maybe for nostalgic purposes, I suppose. I am Todd Green. I'm an associate professor of marketing at the Goodman School of Business at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. I am a huge music fan, first and foremost, and that's the main reason why I got motivated to do some research on both the music industry and then also how people consume music.
So you researched the effect of digital transformations in the music industry on listeners, things like the proliferation of MP3s and other digital file formats and the switch to streaming and so on. So overall, what did you find?
Yeah, one of the, I think the most interesting findings was this idea of reformed music pirates. And so one of the interesting things was they talked about not really feeling guilty anymore because they paid $10. They sort of felt like, yes, I downloaded tens of thousands of songs for free before, but now I stream. Or there were some people who sort of did a mix and match and still liked maybe a vinyl for a special release or for a specific artist that they really liked, and then Spotify for much more of their time. And then actually more recently, I had a paper come out that I actually interviewed people in the Canadian music industry about what the digital shift had done to their own livelihoods. And so it built off the consumer side, and I had a chance to hear how it impacted people who work in the music industry itself as well.
Can you tell me about that latter part? What did you find with respect to Canadian artists, even if this is going back a little ways?
Basically, it was a very similar exercise. We did a typology. So we looked at people who were still very, very angry about Napster and iTunes and felt like musicians have sort of been replaced as not being very important. And some of the stories I heard of artists saying, yeah, people brought burnt albums of ours to meet and greets with the artists, and they were still, you know, heard about it. And I could understand that if your creations are sort of treated like they're of no value. And I couldn't really imagine asking an artist to sign a burnt copy of their album.
Yeah.
It wouldn't go through my mind. But and then there were some people who perhaps had joined the music industry more recently, and they never really expected to make money off album sales and physical copies. And so they looked at it as more of an opportunity. And I did talk to label owners who said, I used to have to sell 100,000 copies of an album physically in order to sort of break even or make some money. And now I don't need to do that. And then there was discussion of the ethics of piracy in the past, and then also the royalties being paid, and talking about artists not necessarily, you know, unionizing, but just being more organized to say, hey, 0.0007 of a cent isn't really a fair payout for my creations, and how, you know, unless you have a trust fund supporting your creation of music, this disappearance of the middle class of musicians was something that came up that was really interesting as well.
Yeah. So can we go back in history a little bit to sort of like what we might think of as kind of the disruption of the iPod era when iTunes came in and people started downloading, but also illicitly downloading music? Can you talk a little bit about the impact of that and what you found in terms of the response of musicians and consumers?
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Apple and Steve Jobs specifically were cited as kind of ruining music and putting a price on it of a dollar for a song, and how, yeah, it was just really, really hard for a lot of musicians to get over that. And some musicians had gone through the transition of signing a fairly sizable recording deal up front prior to that. And so they were fortunate, you know, they were still paid for their physical creations before. But they were recognizing that we're not going to have album release parties, and we're not going to have, you know, people lining up like I did for the newest Pearl Jam or Nirvana in the 90s. That's not going to happen anymore. And listening parties are going to be very low-key events, and we're probably not going to sell a ton of merch on the road. And so, yeah, I think it was scary for a lot of the people I did talk to. Eye-opening. They're also worried about if music was ever going to be valued again because of a specific price being put on one download. And I can't remember now who I was speaking to about this, but the idea of if you have a luxury brand in automobiles, for example, compared to a typical car, you have luxury pricing in other brand categories. But you don't, outside of concert tickets, obviously that varies a lot, but with an album, if I'm buying an album at a CD store, it's typically about $12 to $20. There isn't really a huge premium for Beyonce or Ed Sheeran or Drake and whomever. So the pricing model for luxury brands of the music industry, it doesn't really exist really in physical. And I've always found that kind of interesting too.
Mm-hmm. So once music became available in downloadable formats and peer-to-peer file sharing became common, of course, as we've been talking about, lots of music was pirated. But it does seem like streaming has significantly slowed that practice. Can we talk a bit about music piracy and that transition to streaming?
I think if people are still pirating music now, it would be kind of really unnecessary. So, because even if you're not paying the $10, $12 a month for a streaming service, and I mean, some people may have more than one streaming service because of a specific artist that they want to hear that's not on one platform. It would be, it would not make any sense really to pirate music. I mean, maybe some people felt like they were getting back at the music industry or some sort of distorted view at way, way back. I think once you could pay $10 or even if people want to put up with the free platforms, and there's millions of songs at your disposal on YouTube, for example. So I would think piracy would pretty much be mostly obsolete. I could be wrong when it comes to that, but it's not nearly as rampant as it obviously was when Napster and LimeWire and other platforms came along.
What impact did the advent of the iTunes Store have on the way we listen to music?
It was the first. It was the first joining up of production and consumption all through the same company. Very clever. And Steve Jobs used his connections to some extent, like with the Rolling Stones, you know, to get them to join iTunes and allow their music to be played. I mean, some musicians didn't want it. So it's the complete circle, consumption, production, relatively cheap. I mean, it's quite interesting when you look at iPods. They were marketed far more than Walkmans. Yeah. Because certainly Apple, it was an elite product.
Yes.
So when it first got produced, you just had these images of this beautiful white thing. I've got one, so with the headphones, and it was in posh magazines. So it was for middle-aged people, or anyway, but it was people with money, yeah. And so It took longer to develop in a sense as a popular icon than the Walkman, yeah. And that seemed to have changed once they changed their marketing strategy to have all these adverts where you had silhouettes of young people dancing with their headphones. Yeah. And that's when I think parents started buying these expensive products for their kids. and that joined up with iTunes about the same time as well. And so it became a kind of youth product. Still wealthy, but a youth product, and a product that most people wanted to be associated with in some sense or form. And it was very functional. Mm-hmm. So you have to say it's very functional. I mean, people started getting robbed, you know, because of the iconic white thing showed that you were wearing, you had an iPod, which was worth, I don't know, Canadian dollars, $600 or something. So he then became a potential victim of. And so then people started changing their earbuds to black ones to hide the fact that they had the Walkman. So, of course, and going back to that story with Sony, for example, I was on a platform about 2003 with the head legal person for Sony. And he said, well, you know, our main interest is prosecuting people that are illegally downloading music. So that was their effort, you know. And then I said, well, you can't, it's going to be a massive product. And he said, oh, no, it's not going to catch on. And I said, why not? He said, well, people don't know how to use the technology. And I said, that's what people said about the mobile phone in the 1990s, and that everybody has one. So they Sony were you know, head in the sands, but also torn between the technology company and the music company. And they never recovered from that position.
And so more broadly than just the iPod, what do you think the development of the MP3 as a format meant for portable audio?
On one level, it changed the formatting of music. So the idea that you can, so that's the sound of the fingers, flip from one tune to another, a kind of instantaneous gratification. So the idea of long intros are no-nos. You've got to get into the music very quickly to hold the attention of the person. Yeah. So there's something about speed and the ability to change whatever you want. So, for example, if you had a tape with your Walkman and you decided you didn't like the song, you had to fast forward it and try and get it. And these things are actually quite interesting because then you might have been a bit annoyed about 10 seconds. By the time you got to MP3 players, people were annoyed at 2 seconds. And so that notion of instant what you want, but also formatted much more centrally through that connection between record companies and what will sell, and that the greater manipulation of taste, which we now see with Spotify, etc., with our algorithms, determines what it thinks you like because you like that. Yeah. That was never there before.
Yeah. As we've talked about on the show in previous episodes, artists earning from streaming platforms are very low compared to physical record sales. But is it better than not being paid at all if someone downloads your music without paying for it?
Yeah. One thing I find really interesting is that when bands do speak out about the poor royalties, either there's a few reactions from some fans will say, oh, I had no idea. I feel terribly. I'm going to go to the artist's website and order your back catalog if they don't have it. Or I think some artists really struggle to say, thank you so much for the $4.50 that I made this year from.
Yeah.
But then if they don't, they get sort of vilified as well by fans and saying, oh, well, then why don't you get a different job? Or why? And I think it's hard. If I was an artist and I got a royalty check for $10 at the end of a month or something, it would feel very strange cashing it, or, you know, when you see a $10 deposit on your statement and for your hard work. And then at the same time, you have to be very grateful online and say, thanks. We had 1 million streams of our song and it paid us whatever that would work out to, you know, $780, I think, or something. So it's hard. And I really don't like it when fans vilify artists for talking openly and frankly about the struggles of getting paid nothing for streaming. And some artists do say, if you do want to help out the artist, here's the absolute best way you can do it. Come to a show, buy a t-shirt, buy stuff directly from the artist's website. It's hard to balance that. Thank you for supporting us, but by the way, you're not really making us enough money to sustain my livelihood. What's the best way to approach it? So
The Walkman, as we've discussed, helped proliferate the practice of making mixtapes, which are almost as iconic a sign of the era as the Walkman itself. Mm-hmm. And obviously these were valuable mementos for people. People would keep them in a way that a Spotify playlist probably will never be. How do you think the switch to digital file formats influenced our sense of music ownership?
Yeah, I think it's just access versus ownership, and people don't care perhaps as much about ownership. And I mean, my son is 7 and he now knows how to navigate Spotify and my parents do not. So we had to put a playlist together for my parents for their road trips and stuff because they did not get it. And I like the idea of ownership, and I know there is a segment of population that loves to have a vinyl collection that speaks to their persona and who they are and the artists that they love to support. But I think it's really just about access now. It's the same thing with my outdated DVD collection I have in my basement. I mean, there might be the odd movie that's not on a streaming platform anywhere, or there might be, if I want to listen to Neil Young in the car, it's through his CDs that I own of his, because he's not on Spotify, and I might not go and get another specific streaming service to listen to Neil Young alone. And so it has changed it a lot. And I will admit, even listening in the car, I don't listen to CDs as much as I used to. And I don't have a standalone CD player at home either. So I have a stack of 900 albums at home in various albums, covers and stuff, and laying around the house that I haven't listened to as much because streaming's so much easier.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Spark from CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young, this is Spark, and today we're talking about the impact of the Sony Walkman portable cassette player and how it laid the foundation for all personal audio players that have come after it, right up to our smartphones today. My guests are Todd Green, Associate Professor of Marketing at the Goodman School of Business at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, and Michael Bull, Professor of Sound Studies at the UK's University of Sussex.
The iTunes store specifically brought us to where we are now and where we're going, which is, the unbundling of the album where you could buy single songs. And now people are listening mostly to playlists. That's a trend that started then, and it's just going to become more and more prevalent. I'm Josh Feiner, and I'm a music marketing consultant for entertainment and tech companies. I help artists and companies grow their brand on digital platforms.
I'm old enough to remember the experience of carrying around like a big, you'd have your knapsack and you'd have like a million cassettes in it because, yes, right. You could take the music with you, but it was kind of impractical in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I had a CD booklet that was, not cassettes, but CD booklet. Yeah.
So then carrying on, how do you think the smartphone has changed our experience of personal music and just personal audio more generally, including things like podcasts?
It brought music into more areas of our lives. Originally, I guess it was still focused. Music was in its own kind of area of consumption, but now obviously gaming, podcasts, social media, it's everywhere. And that's going to be a big trend moving forward too, is the embedding music into every aspect of our lives.
Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I think music is going to be everywhere. It already is starting to be everywhere, but everything we do will be linked to each other, and our devices will know exactly what we want before we know we want it, whether that's through our heart rate or different biometrics, things of that, our GPS tracking, things of that nature. It will adapt to what we're feeling. So whether we want to be go for a run and want high tempo music, and we want it to match that, and it knows when we're in the sprint part of our run, or whether we're being productive and it knows certain brain waves that we want to elevate while we're trying to be productive, or sleep, or things of that nature.
This is the idea of like contextualized music, right? To be aware of what we're doing in a particular moment and play music that matches it. How do you think we're going to start to see that playing out going forward?
I think it's going to be, like I said, everywhere. I mean, our devices, they're just going to be more and more of them. And so I think I think there's rumors that like the next AirPods will have heart rate monitoring in them. And so that will link up, let's say, with smartwatches, and smartwatches might link up with your Alexa or Google Home or Siri devices, whatever you have in there. And those might link up with, I think there are some beds now that are coming with speakers. So you could play music out of your bed or your couch. And it's going to be, I mean, even think of something like Peloton. Peloton is a great area for music and fitness in general, and linking that up to your smartwatch, and linking that up to what you have in your ears, and linking that up to on your phone. And it's music is going to become more and more prevalent into every day of our aspects. Now, we probably won't know the artists. We probably might not even know the songs. We'll just hear, oh, I heard that from my Peloton class. So that's, if you hear, you know, teenagers now speak, they'll say that's a TikTok song. They won't know what it is. And so, yeah, that's, I guess, an interesting aspect for artists moving forward.
Yeah. So, yeah, how do you think all of this is going to change the way record companies and artists and music distributors make music?
The songs that rise to the top will be made for these platforms. They'll be made for a specific purpose. So this is a great song to sleep to. This is a great song to run to. This is a great song to party to. And it'll also be made for TikTok. And we've seen even songs now, or TikTok-like platforms, where, you know, it's clear that they were almost made for the platform in terms of if you have like a door knocking sound in your song, that, you know, just makes it so easy for someone to create a video where they're knocking on the door during that part of the song, and things of that nature. And so I think the interaction or the co-creation with music is going to, is another really interesting element where, again, every teenager wants to be a creator, YouTube creator, TikTok creator now. And so having them actually almost co-create songs. Right now, we're just seeing in TikTok duets, but that's such a low. And before that, maybe like karaoke was the background to that or something like that. But that's such that's just the starting point. We're good. We have, you know, once we introduce augmented reality and things of that nature, it's just, it's gonna get very fun.
I mean, obviously, you have massive memory on smartphones, et cetera, et cetera. When my user 15, 16 years ago said, you know, they've got their life in their, sonic life in their iPod. Now people say they've got all of their life on their smartphone. Hence the panic when the batteries have run out or you've left it at home and you feel defenseless. I mean, to some extent, people used to say that with their iPods, you know, they left it at home. What am I going to do? No music. Or the idea of always having something to accompany you. Yeah. And so there's a difference now with you can have, you know, social media, you can have this, that. You've got all sorts of things that are there with you. And to some extent, to ensure that you don't feel alone. And it was quite interesting, even 20 years ago, how many users said, well, what are they most apprehensive about? And they would say the silence.
So do you think streaming is going to continue to be the main way that we consume music for most music consumers?
That was the sense that almost every single person in my interviews felt as well. And I mean, they're much closer to the music industry than I am because they're working within it. And yeah, that was the consensus. I mean, I guess when iTunes and downloading in general came out, streaming services were a ways off. So if there is one other way of music, I suppose it'll be interesting maybe with AR and VR applications as well, like down the road. And I mean, I guess in an era of when we're still in a pandemic, do people want to attend concerts virtually and things like that? It's hard to say. And I know that video games also influence what people listen to, and you can attend virtual concerts through video games and things like that. So there might be, you know, offshoots here and there, but I feel like streaming might be the end game for music consumption.
Yeah. It does make you wonder whether for good or ill, the data that's being gathered by things like our heart rate could play into how the music is made down the road? Like if the data can inform the music creation in some way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's a company called Weave.io, and they create like music variations that can be triggered based off movement, biometrics, GPS, visuals. And so they're embedding that into like the gaming world and the metaverse. And so when you're going around based off your movements and certain biometrics and whatnot, you could trigger different stems from a song, different aspects from a song. So there are other companies like that that are doing things of that nature. So that will be interesting. Almost, we had the unbundling of the album with iTunes, and I think we're going to now have the unbundling of a song, where you'll be able to interact with the different, with just the drums or just the vocals, or you're going to be able to speed it up or slow it down. I could see that happening. Wow. And people and these creators, that's going to be like the next step for them.
Yeah. I mean, we can certainly think of like isolated examples of, you know, so-called album artists, like somebody like a Beyonce or Taylor Swift coming out with albums. But do you think that's going to be sort of more of like a minority niche of artists who are at that album level where we know who they are and we anticipate getting their album, but then there'll be another tier that's sort of more, slightly more generically just music?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. I think that's going to be the 1%. And I mean, I think if you are a creator-led musician, I think you will still have a brand. So if you're, someone who is very creator-focused and you happen to also do music, I think, you know, there'll be anticipation around your album. One of the D'Amelio sisters, I think, does music and, massive on TikTok, started on TikTok and then also does music. And so I think she has a massive following and people will be into her album and her brand because she's a brand. But if you're just an artist releasing music and creation is secondary to the music, then I think they might not know your name. They might not know who you are. They might but they'll listen to your music if it fits what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like music fans are going to be listening to this going like, what?
Yeah, that's why creating now is so important. As if you're an artist, you need to be able to create a brand. And as it's hard as someone, if you're, you know, artist first, artist led, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But there's also an artistry in creation. And being able to connect with fans with these new tools.
Listening to Spark.
You are listening to Spark.
You are listening to
you
Spark.
You are listening to Spark.
With Nora Young.
With Nora Young.
On CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. This week on Spark's Butterfly Effect series, we're talking about the impact of the Sony Walkman, how it set us on a course that enabled technologies like the iPod and streaming apps on our smartphones. I'm speaking to Sound Studies Professor Michael Bull, Marketing Professor Todd Green, and Music Brand Consultant Josh Viner. But where might that technology go from here? Are we on the cusp of a new Walkman-scale invention?
I mean, in the middle, or beginning, middle of pandemic, I don't know, it's all a blur now, but we had those, even a bit before them, the virtual concerts, right? And I think one of the ones that blew up in the beginning of the pandemic, I think, was the Travis Scott in Fortnite. And people thought that's going to be the future of live music and virtual, you know, concerts and whatnot. I think that was maybe due to the pandemic, it got a lot of reaction, a lot of viewers. Everyone was at home. Okay, I'll tune into this. But I think that did spark an interesting conversation in terms of how else can we reach fans and connect with fans. And if, you know, concerts is the main source of income for artists. So if that goes away for a year and a half, 2 years, how else are we going to create, you know, income for ourselves? And so a lot of it is brand focused. If you have a brand and you're not just another artist releasing music, but you have something that, you know, fans are following you for, then you're going to be in a good spot. You're going to be able to create these whether it's a virtual concert or you could do even just a live stream. So many artists did that, things of that nature. You know, I've seen a bunch do like one-on-one FaceTime calls with their fans and things of that. You know, you're gonna have to get a bit creative of how you're interacting with them.
Yeah. So just building on that more broadly, how do you think the metaverse is going to figure into all this?
I think we're still pretty far away from that becoming, adopted on a mainstream level. But mm-hmm. I do think there's definitely a lot of interesting elements that will happen from the idea that you can go into this virtual world, and what's going to be key is interaction. Again, I think it stems now from TikTok duets, but in the metaverse, you're going to need to be able to interact, or else what's, like, when concerts are happening, what's the value in a virtual concert? Really, there's not much value. You could sit at home and watch the concert, sure. But if you can go in and interact in new ways that you can't interact in person, I think that's where there's going to be a big unlock. And once these, right now the virtual concerts are just like a pre-recorded video for the most part. But once these headsets become widely adopted, just like the phone, that's going to make things a lot more intriguing and enticing.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit more about some technologies that might modify or enhance how we experience music?
I used to work with this company that basically artists were able to create their own worlds around their music. And so think of like Pokemon Go, but for artists. And so if you have different elements of you come out with an album, you have different elements of your album, whether it's artwork, whether it's the stems, whether it's different designs, the visual language, and you create different elements, augmented reality elements that fans can then go collect, right, in this world, in the real world, but through their phone or through maybe it's eyeglasses or something like that, and interact with your music. And as they collect more, maybe the album comes together or the song comes together or things of that nature. It's a niche, but there's a really big need or desire for interacting with music. And we see that, again, I go back to TikTok duets. Like, who would have thought that people will want to do that? I think like if you ask people, it seems obvious now, but if you ask people 5 years ago, even, it'd be like, yeah, TikTok duets, like people just prefer to listen. They don't really want to, you know, in the music industry, we talk about lean back listens, which is like listening on a playlist, lean forward listens, which is when someone will go search your song on Spotify. So they're clearly interested. They're leaning into it. A TikTok duet is, I don't know what you call that. It's beyond consumption. It's co-creation.
Yeah.
And the songs that have over 10,000 videos made using them on TikTok, there's a big correlation between them and charting on Spotify playlists. And so those are the songs that pop culture is kind of, you know, going about and leaning into. And I think that there'll be all new forms of interacting with music in the metaverse, in augmented reality, which will come first before the metaverse and that nature.
What about gaming environments? Do you see a role for gaming environments in music consumption or co-creation?
For sure. I think that's probably the next, and it's already happening, but the next frontier. I mean, again, in Fortnite, you had Lil Nas X and Roblox. You had other artists too, but those are the bigger ones. Those are for, again, the 1% artists right now are doing that. But there are a lot of companies that are making that accessible to all artists. And so gaming, when you're gaming, you have a lot of flexibility and freedom that if you're listening to music right now, it is a static thing. You can't change it. But when you're gaming, you can change if it's a shooting game, you could change your weapon. You could change how you, in Fortnite, there are all these skins, right? You could change how you look. You could change the dances that you do. You could change everything. So I think coming back to, you know, songs that are in those games will also, you're going to be able to manipulate them and change them. And it's one thing now to just have a song placed in a game and have a big gamer use it in a Twitch stream. And that's great. That's a great look for your song. But the next step to in terms of consumption will be being able to kind of interact with that song just as you interact with the game. It's the game. The song is part of the game.
Mm-hmm. This episode is part of a series where we look at the kind of outsized effects of one technology on our lives. Mm. So can you imagine what our world might be like if the Walkman had never been invented?
No, not at all. Actually, it's a huge, maybe underappreciated and forgotten, I don't want to say art form necessarily of the mixtape per se, but I think it's an invention that we can easily trace back to where we're at with music now and people using their smartphones for streaming. There's a direct link along the lines, even along to the ill-fated mini disc player that I had that I don't think I ever really figured out until I got an MP3 player a couple of years later that, yeah, this is where it started. And it made music on the go, and you could make your road trip go faster or your bus ride or your commute go faster or maybe your workouts better and things like that. And I still remember trying to balance my Discman while on like an exercise bike or something like that way, way back, right? And it was like, this is so silly. I can't think when I was 12 or 13 with probably Pearl Jam or Nirvana skipping repeatedly and scratching my CDs. But there is this huge moment for a lot of people, and I think there's nostalgia, and I can't imagine the prices for Walkman that are in good shape on eBay, for example. So, yeah, I think it's a huge turn in our music consumption, and then it's just carried on with a number of new inventions as we go.
I think these devices give you more control over yourself, the spaces you move in, and your relations to other people than ever before. So they're very powerful. And they've actually changed the structure of private and, more importantly, public space in a way that we would never have imagined when the Walkman started. And there is a kind of narrative and journey of that transformation of how we experience places and maybe time to orientate those things to ourselves. Yeah? So we see the world through the technologies and the sounds and the music more than ever before.
Yeah.
So to give you an example, someone told me, well, you know, when I go to New York, I put a tape on of New York music because that makes it New York for me. So New York itself doesn't do it. So there's that notion of bringing the world to you, but through your own presuppositions or your own soundtrack or your own relationship to whatever it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of speculative, but can you foresee a time when we get our entertainment from some kind of bio enhancement, you know, in a way that we won't need something like a smartphone or a watch, like, I don't know, chips inserted behind our ears?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think like Bluetooth headphones, I'll say AirPods, are kind of the first iteration of that. You know, but people walk around AirPods like they don't even have them in their ear.
Yeah.
It just, you don't feel them even sometimes. And so imagine that 20 years from now, they're going to become smaller and smaller. Whether you put it in and out of your ear, or it's just, yeah, inside of you, like implanted into you, for sure. I think there'll be that. It'll probably be connected to our clothing. It'll be connected to our watch. It'll be connected to our shoes, to everything. So it will know where you are, how you feel, what you do, and it will adjust based off that.
Mm. Josh Viner is a music brand consultant in Toronto. Michael Bull is professor of sound studies at the University of Sussex. Todd Green is associate professor of marketing at Brock University. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Adam Killick, Olzi Sirokana, Samruit Johannes, and me, Nora Young. And by Michael Bull, Todd Green, and Josh Viner. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.